Hello everyone, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergence Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with SocianWorks, a global forum helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. Our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, and so ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy. They're reframing how we build for resilient futures. So in this podcast, we are examining the ways in which dynamic systems of information, incentives, and interaction are reshaping the societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated. They're being replaced with ecosystemic models, which are our new economic engines for the digital era. I'm Marco Annunziata. I'm the co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm the former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. My expertise lies at the intersection of economic trends with technology and innovation. I'm joined today by our guest, Wendy Gonzalez. Wendy is an executive passionate about building high-performing, high-functioning teams that develop and scale innovative and impactful technology. She has two decades of managerial and technology leadership experience at companies such as Ernst & Young, Capgemini, Cycle 30, which was acquired by Arrow Electronics, and General Communication. Wendy brings a wealth of expertise to every role. She also serves as an active board member of the Leila Ajana Foundation, and we are thrilled to have her on the podcast. Wendy, welcome on the podcast. Floor over to you if you want to tell anything else about yourself to our audience, or otherwise just jump into what you are doing right now.
Great. Well, I'm so glad to be here, Marco. Thank you so much for inviting me on the podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. So for the last roughly 9 years, I've been at Sama, and I'm the CEO of Sama. We are a company that focuses on helping Fortune 500s and large global enterprises develop the world's leading AI models through our data labeling and model evaluation solutions. So we sit at the data layer of AI, and I'm really excited to talk about the impact of this technology, what it means to, like you said, the intersection of the economy and humankind. So I'm looking forward to our discussion.
That's outstanding. And so Wendy, to explain better to our audience what you're actually doing, your clients are huge clients, Fortune 500 companies. Your company, Sama, is involved in various aspects of helping these companies develop functional, effective, and powerful AI models. A piece of it, if I understand it correctly, is the data labeling, so making the data themselves usable by the artificial intelligence models. Can you tell us a bit more about this and about your business model in general?
Yes, absolutely. So AI, all AI is built off of data. It's pattern recognition, right? So how do you look and process data? And then how do you basically predict then outcomes? So essentially, it's garbage in, garbage out. So if you don't have the right data or access to the right data when you're building your models, whether it is regular machine learning or generative AI, you can end up with non-performant systems. So our goal is really to help provide our clients with a very strong pipeline to manage and structure the data that these companies are using to build their AI models, because it's critical to accurate and performant models. And one of the things that we do that has been interesting is that we, of course, have a technology platform that allows us to process the data, to leverage automation, to sort and filter the data, to, in some cases, do automated validation or annotation. But the key component of this is that automation does not drive everything. It's critical to have a human in the loop and human judgment be part of actually validating and confirming whether the data itself is accurate, is in the right tone if you're talking about generative AI. So we have a combination of a platform and humans in the loop. Beyond that, one last point is that we do have a social mission as well. So our focus is to help bring women, young men, youth from underserved communities into the digital economy by providing them full-time employment and living wages to support this entry-level annotation work.
This may be actually one of the most valuable aspects of this. We've talked many times of how technology, especially digital technology, should be helping us to create more opportunities for everybody, both in the US and across the world. And so this is another, it's another piece of it. Just to be very clear, Wendy, so your efforts in making the data more right, making data usable, not more usable, very literally usable. They are extended to every kind of data, right? So this is written material, it's recordings, it's images. Does it extend across the board?
Yes, it's all type of data. So it could be vision data, which is typically described as images, videos. It could be 3D, 3D image data, which is point clouds for sensor, from sensor or LiDAR. It is also text, of course. It's audio. It's really data in all formats can be leveraged to develop AI.
That's excellent. And then we'll come back to the issues of your social impact later in our discussion. But I think it's a very interesting point what you were saying, Wendy, which is, and you stressed that there is an important human component to this, because humans are needed to intervene, to check, to make sure that the data are good quality and that the output of the models is good quality. And we'll come back to this. But I'm very curious, we're in a situation where a lot of companies across sectors, industry, finance, etc., are getting very excited about artificial intelligence, especially with the advent of general artificial intelligence. They're being told all over the place by the media and by consultants that this is going to be essentially the magic dust that sprinkled everywhere, can transform their operations and yield major improvements in efficiency. I've always found that the devil is in the details in these situations. So implementing, executing the technology. And so I'm curious, what are you finding in your experience with your clients, how they approach the introduction of artificial intelligence in their strategies, and what your advice would be, what your advice is to executives who want to make artificial intelligence a bigger part of their strategies?
It's been really interesting. So AI itself has been around for more than a couple of decades. So this idea of leveraging machine learning, deep learning, to have machines process data, predict outcomes. But what's happened over the course of the last few years has been that the technology has advanced so much, in particular with generative AI, that I think everybody, certainly investors, boards, the ones who also believe and are driving this belief that sprinkle the magic dust, as you said, because it will drive cost efficiencies, really believe that these latest advancements in technology truly democratize the adoption at enterprises, because now you've got lower code solutions. You don't have to be a coding expert. There are tools and platforms like these LLM models and these general artificial intelligence models that make it easier for customers to deploy. So that has really, between that and the promise that it could drive sort of double the GDP or create efficiencies of nearly 40 or 50% across any and all use cases, is really creating this hype that, hey, we need to be able to sprinkle that magic dust. But I think what's really happening as all of these things are being explored by companies in a very meaningful way, is they're asking themselves, what is the cost benefit? Okay, so if I am going to invest all of this time, energy, do I have the expertise, right? Do I understand the use case I'm building this for? Will it drive a benefit that is worth that level of investment? And that is the number one discussion, because between GPU costs, right? How much these chips cost, the cloud computing, the level of expertise is necessary to deliver this. What came as, hey, we could apply this to hundreds of use cases. Now companies are taking a step back and saying, okay, what's the ROI? Will I get more adoption? Will I be able to drive efficiency by X percent?
Are you finding that in order to get a better handle on the ROI, are companies tending to focus almost exclusively on cost reduction, efficiency gains? Or are you seeing companies which are already eyeing the possibility of driving greater growth, greater revenue growth?
So we see more focus on the cost efficiency piece right now. So I think that really has to do with a couple of things. One is it's easier to adopt. There's less worry about making customer facing, because I think we've probably all seen some of the disasters that have been out there that have been very publicly embarrassing, whether it's misinformation or reputational risk. And so taking that first step internally seems to be the place that most are going. But we also have tended to work quite often really in product development. So these are companies that are on the leading edge of this technology saying, if I need to leverage generative AI. So think of like a search engine, or social media platforms, things of that nature that say, hey, this is really critical to our adoption of our products.
And you've mentioned the issue of costs. Now, this is important both from a micro perspective of the level of the individual companies, but also at the macro level. One big issue, you pointed out the fact that artificial intelligence is very computationally intensive and therefore it requires a lot of energy. I've seen some, frankly, very scary projections on how much more energy would be needed to feed the projected development of artificial intelligence in the coming decades, in a situation where we are undergoing an energy transition towards renewables, which already has challenges of its own. We're seeing Microsoft striking a deal to reopen the nuclear power plant at Three Mile Island. What is going on here? Is this kind of AI development we're envisioning sustainable at all? And if so, how?
The Three Mile Island was really, that announcement was incredibly eye-opening. And I'll frame it in a couple of examples. I was actually just speaking to an executive of a data storage company whose company is doing very well because of the boom in AI. And he shared as an example, an episode at the beginning of this season, for anybody who's seen Ted Lasso, by the time they got to the end of the season, that same episode was 8 times larger in terms of data. And the reason why it was 8 times larger in terms of data is that with generative AI, you have the ability to target advertising, to do product placement. So as a result of having these great tools out there, people are, the content is getting richer and more attributable, right? To take advantage of all of this processing capability. So what's happening is the data is growing at a pace that is far faster than the efficiency of the GPUs. So even though GPUs are getting so much more efficient, the cost of AI is still going up every few months. Actually, there's a study from Epic that said it has gone up roughly 2.4x every 4 months because of this. The pace of that demand and the richness of the data is outpacing the efficiency. And what does that do? That creates this tremendous strain. So what's really interesting is I was speaking to some other experts in the field, and when we talk about things like ROI frameworks, of course, we're talking about, well, how much cost is it for GPUs and cloud computing and teams and expertise. But what about the energy costs associated with it? When you've got a company like Microsoft, and they're also planning to build making a large investment, roughly $1 billion to build a data center in Kenya to support the same thing, because Kenya has a lot of renewable energy and wind power. But you start to think about it this way, and the cost as a whole, while I think eventually it will catch up because those costs will get passed back down to the buyers, but it is creating friction. In fact, Marco, I was meeting with some folks as I was just earlier this week at the COGEX Festival, and one of the challenges that's happening in Ireland right now, I'm sure we're all aware that many companies and large tech companies moved to Ireland post-Brexit or around Brexit, that actually it is creating a strain on the grid that is raising energy costs for the average consumer now in that region, which is creating its own challenges. So you think about that, that is, talk about societal and economic impacts. This is absolutely something to consider that I just don't think gets quite enough airtime right now.
No, that is huge. And it's interesting, as we're discussing it now at the macro level and the impact on consumers, I find it interesting that it comes at a time when I'm seeing some academic economists pushing back a bit against the hype of how much efficiency and growth, economic growth, AI can generate at the national level. There's an interesting article recently by Darun Acemoglu, who's an MIT economist who's done a lot of work on artificial intelligence, automation, and the impact on productivity and employment. And his argument, he says, look, I look at the numbers and I actually doubt that the impact is going to be so transformational at the macro level. He says that maximum he could see it impacting about 5% of existing jobs, with a positive impact on US-wide productivity, which is negligible. It's less than 0.1% per year, so almost insignificant. And part of it is he is also building in part the fact that the energy costs are going to be a brake on the adoption, in part the fact that it's going to be more and more difficult for companies to deploy this technology at scale in an effective way. So this brings me back to the conversation, to what you were saying earlier, which is the ROI discussion, number one, and how do companies find the most effective application? Because there's no doubt that on specific applications, this technology is extremely powerful. But secondly, something else you've mentioned and I would like to hear a bit more about, which is the human talent which is necessary to leverage these abilities. Do you find that companies have the right talent, the right understanding which is needed to make this happen? And if not, how do they go about acquiring it or building it?
Yes, I think it really varies to the short answer to the question. But I'd frame it like this, and this is something we see very consistently, is that it's incredibly important that people understand the use case that they are leveraging AI for, to say, hey, we're going to use AI to get more efficient broadly. Okay, wow. You actually have to translate that into a very specific use case or application. And to your point, there are some that I think are relatively clear. So we're seeing a real revolution in customer experience or omnichannel contact centers, as an example, right? It's a very high human cost. It's well understood that technologies like RPA have been leveraged in the past to make intranets and other information more available so that the rep themselves can reduce average call handling time. Well, now there's a very strong push towards pilots or co-pilots, right? That then can either replace or guide what the customer experience looks like. And so there is a view, there's an ROI, right? Hey, can I reduce the number of call center agents, as an example, by X amount to leveraging this technology? There are other considerations, though, which is, what is the customer experience? I have to admit, I'm one of those people who I'm like, agent. Every time I get into the IVR at the very beginning of the conversation,
yes.
I'll yell from the rooftops if I feel like I really need to speak to somebody. And so these are all the types of considerations. That's one where there's a little bit of clarity. But I was just having a conversation with some executives at SaaS companies. So a lot of these large companies are like, hey, I think we need to build co-pilots as well, because we can create much more rich or targeted support. So for example, if we are an HR solution, what if we can actually automate a significant amount of the filtering of resumes for talent acquisition by leveraging generative AI, and we can create a much richer, better feature? And they are beginning to ask themselves questions like, well, do I need to build my own LLM for that? Should I just inject our own data? Is this unique information going to give us an actual lift? And does that translate to new user licenses, greater adoption, et cetera? And so they're really starting to ask themselves a question that says, okay, I mean, I know this is going to be beneficial, but how do I translate that? And so the use cases and what I would describe as the intentionality is incredibly important, because one of the biggest challenges that we see is that people come and say, hey, I know this is going to be a good idea, but they actually don't know what they want their model to benefit or do. So we end up spending a ton of time, for example, and even on the data side, of identifying quality rubrics. So, well, what does good look like? Like, very simply put, and it's like, well, how good does it need to be? Does it need to be really good? In the case of a self-driving car, it's a little bit more self-evident, because you have to be able to recognize motorcycles and vans and different types of cars and weather events and things of that nature. What happens when it is a co-pilot to adjust the mirror? Does that need to be super accurate? What does that experience need to look like? And companies do struggle with that a bit. And I would say that depending on leading one sort of early adopter versus kind of early majority, we see a huge variety of sort of expertise. And oftentimes, especially on the data side, we find even with leading companies, they don't quite have that sorted. So we spend a lot of time on that.
My guess would be that a lot of the companies you go into don't even have a coherent data strategy to begin with as you approach them, right? Because my experience, at least in the industrial sector, has been data tend to be stored where they are locally needed, locally in terms of the local business units that produces them. How much of an effort do companies need to make to take a holistic look at the data they have and therefore realize where the value might be, right? Because it seems to me part of the advantage of this new technology should be to ask ourselves, what could I do today with AI and the data that I couldn't do before? But for this, I need to know all the data I have access to, not just the ones that are in front of my nose because I see them on my own spreadsheet every day.
That is hugely important because one of the biggest values of generative AI is that you're able to process mass amounts of data and turn it into something cohesive and effective. So imagine if you are, for example, one of the many large hardware providers, you've got laptops. Well, what sits inside your firewall? What's on your local machine? How could that increase productivity? You start to really expand your world and start to say, I've really got to take a look at all the data I have, because at the end of the day, that becomes the differentiator of how you can provide a differentiated solution, is if you can unlock the value of that data. But then second, as you think about your AI strategy, well, how much of that do you want to make sure that you keep within your company? Because depending on what approach you're using, if you're leveraging one of these LLMs or LMMs that are out there, if you're doing the enterprise version, maybe there's a way to protect and keep your data, not from contributing to the model. But if you're not careful, or if you're not really being very thoughtful about that approach, we've seen a lot of cases, some really pretty embarrassing ones where it's like, oops, we didn't mean to give you our trade secrets, OpenAI or whoever that they use the model of. But it's very interesting because I was speaking to an expert in responsible AI frameworks. So that's really, how do you develop AI responsibly? It's about transparency, data provenance, you name it. And one thing that we've been spending a lot of time talking about is education. So even, Mark, you were mentioning, do we see internal use cases and external use cases? Well, even in the case of internal use cases, I know that when a lot of these new models came out, we had to bring all of our engineers together, because your engineers are always out in front of things. They're like checking out the new technology. They're playing around. We had to say like, hey guys, like stop. We need to have a policy around how you're leveraging these tools, because even in the case of prompt engineering, many people don't realize that the prompt that you're creating is going to feed and train that model. And people use personal data and information all the time when they are creating this stuff. And it's like, just even have the education that says, hey, like, let's just be sure we know. And then what is the policy? Yeah.
Wendy, this is very relevant. We'll come back to this in a second. I was going to ask you something that is one of my pet concerns and curiosities. How much progress are you seeing in terms of addressing the hallucinations, which are the other major shortcoming of these models?
Yes, hallucinations are, in generative AI, are a primary concern. I mean, if you think about it, right, here are these models. They're so powerful. They're very smart. Many of them nowadays are even leveraging synthetic data to be trained upon.
Yep.
So it's like, if your copy of your copy is training your copy, kind of a thing, it's pretty crazy.
Then you can have something like what happened to me the other day, when I apologize for interrupting you, but I wanted to give you this funny anecdote. I was doing some work on U.S. employment growth over the past several years. So I was looking at the relation of employment and immigration. And so just for fun, I asked one of the generative AI engines, okay, tell me how much employment has been created by the private sector in the U.S. over the past 10 years. And the generative AI gave me a very detailed answer with job creation numbers for every year for the past 10 years and the percentage increases. I took one glance at it and I thought, okay, so you're telling me that the private sector created about 30 million jobs per year, but you know, in 10 years, that fills up the entire population of the U.S. Employment, the private employment in the U.S. is about 135 million. So there's something here. So it was such a funny example of hallucination by an AI clearly trying to please me and saying lots of jobs. But it's striking. So something like this, it's so glaring that you catch it. You say, okay, fine. But it's dangerous. I'm sorry, I've interrupted you. I thought it would.
It's a perfect example, right? So it's pulling all this information together, trying to predict or create the next word. And there's a Gartner report out there that estimates, in terms of some of the trends, that in the next 10 years, like 10% of a company's budget could be spent on combating misinformation and hallucinations. Mm-hmm. And as you think about what that happens, I've used some examples before with. You can literally do this with some of the search engines today. I did this live to show some of our board members the other day, just to give them a view of these hallucinations, where you say, hey, tell me, can I cook spaghetti with gas? Well, clearly what the human meant is on a gas stove, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to an electric stove. Yeah. So the response comes back and says, absolutely, yes. Let me give you four recipes of how you put gasoline and pasta with your marinara. It's like so like whoa, crazy. But the thing that I think is even crazier, why it's so important to have these things in mind and to have an appropriate strategy and that human in the loop that we're talking to, you're the human loop that caught that, is so incredibly important because the breadth is so large of these. Is all the data going to be right coming into it? Well, okay, probably not. If synthetic data is being used or you're leveraging data sources off the internet, do we truly believe that those sources are going to be bias-free and always correct? No, right? So what becomes incredibly important when we think about that strategy and like, what are you trying to build with your use case? So if you're building a super targeted use case, which is, okay, because there's general artificial intelligence, which has so many potential challenges, or I should say, could result in that. Or you're doing something very specific like financial mortgage applications. Well, imagine that. So I kind of laugh about the obvious cook, don't use gasoline in your spaghetti. Doesn't make it any tastier, nor is it a good idea, to something that is way scarier, right? So there's a fairly well publicized, unfortunate situation with an Amazon recruiting model years ago where they built it. It makes a lot of sense, right? We can automate this, just look for pattern recognition and then figure out and bring up the top candidates. Well, it was an application built for engineers, and it basically deduced that women weren't qualified. Well, why? Because they only represented a tiny little fraction. So you had this inference on a faulty data set, but a non-representative data set. And so the thing that is tricky is that like models and AI and the way we develop this technology, we're never going to know everything, right? Like since when, if you've ever done development, did you have all the requirements? You don't know that all front. That's why people started using Agile instead of rational unified processing, because you don't have everything done at every point in time. By the time you end, something's changed. Well, even if we know that's the case, you still have to come at your model development with some level of intentionality. That intentionality, that's really the goal of these responsible AI frameworks, to say, okay, well, what am I really building this use case for? What is the data that I need? How am I going to evaluate it? Do I have some sort of a human-centric validation process where I can just make sure at some point in time that there are checks and balances, that I know that the output of this is both accurate, could also be to have the right sentiment or tone. What's sitting in the data? What is it missing? Where is it performing poorly? So how do I come back in and retrain that model to get it smarter and smarter over time? And then how do I maintain it? So even once you let it out in the wild, right, it's going to get new data is going to come in. And to keep that model performant, you need to have that process.
Well, you said here, Wendy, is so important because the example you were giving, the Amazon example, there is a profound lesson there because we tend to think of this technology, especially generative AI, as something that can open incredible new possibility, new creative possibility. And the example you give proves beyond doubt that if we don't use it right, it does exactly the opposite. It closes your mind because it looks at the past rather than what is possible. It looks at the past, it crystallizes it, and if we then take it as a truth because it comes from the machine, then it's tremendously dangerous. So your point that it needs intentionality on our part, we need to be very deliberate on how we use this as a tool, and why, I think, is extremely important. Now, on a related note, you've alluded to some of the PR disasters that some companies have encountered deploying generative AI. You talked about the risk of companies letting their trade secret and data escape through the use of OpenAI frameworks. Tell me a little bit more about what you see as the main risks as artificial intelligence gets embedded in systems like finance that we've discussed, but also healthcare. What are the big risks that concern you and how can they be addressed?
Yeah, it's a really, Mark, it's a great question. It's really tricky because I think especially in the fields of technology and science and research, regulation and compliance is not really not always the best answer, right? Yet at the same time, there need to be guardrails put in place. So when we think about things, I mean, even I'll give an example of what I think is a positive thing, which is when California set out to put green emission standards and the way that televisions and vehicles were being manufactured. Well, yes, it was a compliance put out there, but gosh, it got everybody thinking about, okay, what do I need to do to make my product more cleaner and more efficient? Well, the same token, you don't want to stifle innovation, but there's got to be some balance. So actually, I think it was recently, I think it was Meta who announced they're going to be leaving the EU. So I don't know if you're familiar with the EU AI Act, but the EU AI Act put together a framework that said, hey, if you've got high-risk systems, and the U.S. and California tried to do something similar, although the bill was recently vetoed, is, hey, if you're a technology that is, or business that is more than $100 million, you need to worry about cybersecurity attacks so these people can't leverage this technology to be used for a cyber attack of some sort that could be catastrophic. What if you have a sensitive or high-risk systems like financial systems, policing, surveillance, things that certain populations could be really biased against or discriminated against? All the way to data privacy. Did you get permission to use the data that you're using? Do you have an evaluation system? So anyhow, there's quite a bit out there. And I think the only way we get there is going to be through a lot of, I think to a certain extent, common sense and public-private partnerships. We know that the government's not necessarily going to be on the leading edge of any technology and what this technology could be. But at the same time, I think if these technologies are going to be so ubiquitous and being built, we have to be thinking about, is there a risk to some of these systems? Are we protecting people's privacy? Is there education and awareness? I think without a guardrail, we're going to be pretty challenged. And I do think that it is possible, I don't mean to sound like paranoid, but it is possible that potentially biases that currently exist could be furthered, right? Mm-hmm. So that whole notion of, and I think you put it so excellently, which is a lot of this is looking at the past. Well, if you got it all right in the past, then no problem. If it was not necessarily well represented in the past, then there could be a challenge, yeah.
Indeed. That's a very important point. And I think especially as some of these shortcomings become apparent, taking action, even regulatory action to start addressing it, I think should be paramount. Wendy, let's go to the other important part of what we wanted to discuss, which is the social impact of your work. You've mentioned it at the beginning, but I really want to hear more. You were saying part of what SAMA does, part of what your work does is not just keep the humans at the center of the equation, but also trying to have a disproportionate, hopefully, impact on sectors of the population that have been disproportionately disadvantaged so far. Tell me more.
Yeah, absolutely. So this really comes about, and I think in a couple of ways. One is that talent is everywhere. Talent is distributed equally, but opportunity is not. And if we only looked at what was in front of us, we'd be missing out on all this incredible human capital. And I feel strongly about that. Sama actually means equal in Sanskrit. What we're trying to do is level the playing field and connect and people who didn't normally have either the network or the resume or the CV, so primarily working in the informal economy, to entry-level jobs in the formal economy. And that is really important because there's all of this work and sort of economic value being created. Why shouldn't everybody be a part of it? Doesn't need to be focused on small groups. We have an opportunity to create a tremendous amount of jobs through this process. And that is a really positive thing. It's a positive impact of AI is that we can create wealth. We can see that in countries like India and the Philippines, they're able to really grow entire middle classes and create millions of jobs through supporting some of the digital transformation work. And I see it no different for AI. But the other component of this beyond that is we took a specific approach around employment. And one of the reasons why employment or full-time work is different than crowdsourcing, which is what a lot of companies leverage because people work out in the crowd. And I mean, I think it does create a lot of opportunity, but what you get is the instructions in that task and people only get paid if they complete the task or they believe they're completing the task. So I had a neighbor doing this and they just for fun had some time click, just kept clicking until they got the answer right. Like just click, right? Cause then I did what it wanted me to do. So fantastic. I got paid. There's all sorts of crazy things out there about fraud and many other things where people, I mean, naturally are just trying to earn a living, but it doesn't necessarily create a quality outcome. And in the full-time model, everybody gets a baseline set of pay. Right. So the incentive can be for quality. So that's one thing that we found that has been very valuable. But the second point, so I'm going a little long on this, but the second point I would probably mention is that representation is important. Can you imagine if you built a globally embedded technology, but it was with one type of people, one demographic in a very small group? Everybody deserves a seat at the table. In fact, I think it's incredibly important to bring a diverse set of people through the entire supply chain of development.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's actually one of the issue of this intersection of new technologies like artificial intelligence and employment, especially with the social dimension, is one of the most difficult and fascinating issues in my mind. But I think an approach like yours, which recognizes the importance and the value that human beings bring to the table, first of all, in conjunction and in complementarity with machines, but secondly, also the importance of creating opportunity across the board, for me, is the most fundamental value and contribution, because it really is the best way to and to lift everyone and to move away from the more controversial discussions on discrimination and redistribution. I think the most direct way is, how do you give everybody as much as possible equal access to opportunity? I think what you're doing is exactly this. That's a very important point. Wendy, we're coming to the end of our allotted time for the conversation. Unfortunately, this was fantastic. I think our audiences will have learned an enormous amount. Is there anything, I'm going to leave you with the last word, is there anything that you think we should have covered in our conversation and didn't? Any last words of wisdom for the audience?
We've covered some incredible ground, Marco, so thank you so much for the opportunity to share this. I'll probably just wrap up by saying what you just said so articulately well, which is everybody deserves an opportunity to be part of this, to benefit from this AI revolution and the evolution of where things are going. Everybody deserves a seat at the table and to be a part of the economic boom that this is part of. It's important for just equity and equity, but well beyond that, it's for representation. These technologies don't know borders. So thank you so much for the opportunity to catch up. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. I'm Wendy Gonzalez, CEO of Sama. Thank you very much for being on our podcast. And thanks everyone for joining us today. Please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on the Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts, and you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you very much.